Welcome to NACSW's Podcast of the Month. Our podcast program makes available recordings of a wide variety of NACSW presentations and discussions on topics of particular interest to Christians and social work. Our Podcast of the Month program features a new podcast every 30 days for your listening pleasure. We hope you enjoy today's podcast.
So now, without any further ado, I'm delighted to present our speaker, Kenneth Smith. It's all yours, Ken.
Thank you so much, Rick. I'm honored to be with you all this afternoon and hope and pray this will be a fruitful time for all of us. I'd like to give you some brief background about my interest in motivational interviewing, which I'm going to refer to as MI for the rest of our time together. I was exposed to MI a few years ago by some colleagues of mine during my training to be credentialed as an addiction specialist in the state of North Carolina. During the spring of 2008, I happened to be reading a colleague's copy of the NASW News and saw an ad from a group that was recruiting 200 clinicians from across the country from nonprofit agencies to be trained in MI. 100 would be trained in 2008 and 100 would be trained in 2009. The training was sponsored by and was being held in Albuquerque, New Mexico, by a group led by the co-founder of MI, William Miller. Since I was working as a clinician in a nonprofit hospital, I applied for one of the 200 spots and by God's grace was accepted. So in the fall of 2008, I flew to New Mexico and participated in 3 days of intensive training in MI with 99 other clinicians from all across the country. At the end of the training, we did a role play in which we did an MI session with a person role playing a client. That session was recorded, and I was given specific feedback on how I did. After the training, we agreed to record 3 other MI sessions with actual clients of ours, of course, with their written permission, over a year's time, and those recordings were sent to the training group, and I received written feedback about how I did. We also received 3 months of additional phone training with a certified MI trainer. It turns out that the 200 clinicians were part of a research project to test whether 2 ways of training clinicians in MI would lead to different abilities to evoke and respond to client change talk, and we're going to be talking about the concept of client change talk in a few minutes. Specifically in substance abuse treatment sessions. I was recently told that I was in the group that received the enhanced MI training and thus was supposedly more likely to be effective at using MI skills with clients. The group plans to publish the results soon. I will find out if indeed I was more effective than the other group. Since then, I have found MI to be tremendously useful in my clinical work. I doubt a day goes by that I don't use MI skills. Shortly after the training, I began to ponder about how MI could be integrated with biblical values and particularly how Jesus may have used MI skills. This workshop is a result of what I learned during my MI training, plus my own thinking and research from others' thinking about how Jesus modeled and used MI skills, and even some ways in which Scripture is compatible and is at odds with MI. I'm not a trained theologian, but so some of the biblical ideas are just my own thinking, and I hope that you'll find it helpful. So here we go. Slide number 2, I have the workshop objectives. I examine the core theory and principles of MI, gain an understanding of the strategies and skills of MI, discover how Jesus modeled and used MI skills, and learn strategies for integrating biblical faith with MI. I'd like to start with a pretest, and since we're being muted here, I just want you to answer this question to yourself and see how you do on this pretest. And it's found in slide number 3. I will say a question, and you can think to yourself whether this question is true or false. Number 1, motivational interviewing convinces clients to change even if they don't want to. And that is false because the MI skills will not be effective if the person is not motivated to change. We cannot change anyone, but we can influence them. And the current problem that the client has to be in conflict with a cherished value of theirs, and we'll be talking about that later on. So number 1 is false. We can't change anybody no matter what skills we're using. Number 2, MI is relevant for substance abuse but not other issues. Well, that is false because MI started out in substance abuse, but now it's used for a lot of other problems, and we're going to talk about that in a minute. Number 3, MI is useful for all clients. And actually, that is also false, because if a client is already ready to change and is making a plan toward change, we don't want to talk them back into ambivalence, but we want to focus on the fact that they are already ready to change. And MI often is not useful for clients that are into resistance, and we're going to talk about resistance later on. Number four, MI is something that is used in place of other skills. And that is false, because MI can add to and it blends very well with other approaches. It's certainly not the be-all and end-all. And number five, MI can be combined with a confrontational style. And that is also false, because confrontation is on the opposite end of the continuum of NI. MI believes that direct persuasion is not an effective method for resolving ambivalence, but instead, when we try to use direct persuasion, the client gets more defensive and they argue for it actually not changing. So I hope that you got an A on though on that pretest. All the questions there were false. Let's talk for a few minutes about the roots of MI, and I'm just going to do a brief history. You can certainly read more about this in motivational interviewing textbooks referred to on your last slide with my references. But basically, the concept of MI evolved from experience in treating problem drinkers, where Dr. William Miller and others began to have doubts about coercive confrontation. Those of you that have done substance abuse work for a long time might know that in the 70s and 80s, the big deal was to confront addicts, call them addicts, tell them that they needed to change, tell them that they were bad and they were negatively influencing the people around them. And what we found is that just doesn't work, that when people get confronted and get called names, they often get more defensive. So Miller first published an article in 1983, and by 1991, the fundamental concepts of MI began to take shape, particularly when he combined with Dr. Stephen Rolnick, who developed the concept of ambivalence. Miller was also influenced by Carl Rogers, his client-centered unconditional positive regard, where basically the worker is seen as the caboose and the client is seen as the train, and we are to follow the client's direction. But MI has a twist on that, because there are times that MI is consciously directive and consciously trying to help the client resolve that ambivalence toward change, and we're going to be talking about that later on. Another theory that Miller used that I was not familiar with, but I really find fascinating, is a theory from Daryl Bem. He's a psychologist who came up with what he calls a self-perception theory, and that is that people tend to become more committed to that which they hear themselves defend. So if the client himself or herself is hearing themselves talk about change and hearing the therapist talk about change, they're much more likely to do it. And then the final type of theory that Miller was influenced by was Prochaska and DiClemente, their stages of change, the trans-theoretical model of change, and we're going to talk about that later on. So MI now is certainly an accepted practice, and many people are being trained in it. And moving to the next slide, you can see that MI is not only applicable for substance abuse, but for many other problems. You can see the list of problems there that you can use for MI. It's very good for people that want to stop smoking and or losing weight, and maybe they have ambivalence about it, medication compliance, really any situation in which a client can be ambivalent, where part of them wants to change and part of them doesn't want to change, MI can be useful for. At this point, slide number six, MI is being well researched. There's been over 200 controlled clinical trials that have tested the effectiveness of MI, and Hetman, Steele, and William Miller in 2005, and this is actually on the Motivational Interviewing website, they have a list of all the research projects that have been done on MI. And what has come out of the research is that MI is very good on helping people reduce their substance abuse. It is very good on helping people increase their change talk and decrease resistance. And MI has also been proven very effective for helping people comply with behaviors such as taking medication, sticking to their diet, things like that. So MI is a well-researched methodology at this point. Let's move on to slide number seven to the definition of MI. And from the textbook, the Motivational Interviewing textbook of 2002 by Miller and Rolnick, they define MI as being a client-centered, directive method for enhancing intrinsic motivation to change by exploring and resolving ambivalence. And that will be a question on your test at the end. I'm going to give you hints about the questions that are going to come at the end of the workshop, the CEU questions, and there will be a question about MI exploring and resolving ambivalence. There's a new definition that came out last year, and this is a really long one, but it really is more specific about what MI is trying to do. And this newly evolved definition is on your slide, and it's a collaborative, goal-oriented method of communication with particular attention to the language of change. It's intended to strengthen a person's motivation for and commitment to a target behavior change by listening and exploring the person's own arguments for change. So that's the basic theme and the theory of what MI is trying to accomplish. Let's talk a little bit about ambivalence, because this is the core issue of MI, trying to help clients resolve ambivalence. I'm sure if not a day goes by that in some way, shape, or form, you don't hear your client say, "I want to change, but I really don't want to." And you hear these ambivalent statements all the time with the people you work with. And what we find is ambivalence certainly is normal. We all get into ambivalence about a lot of different things. I have some examples on the slide there. We may have ambivalence about changing jobs. We may have ambivalence about eating junk food. We really, really, really enjoy junk food, but we know it's bad for us. I personally have a lot of ambivalence about security screening in airports. I know it's necessary, but I certainly don't enjoy it. And hopefully by this point, nobody's having ambivalence about being at this workshop, although maybe a few of you already are. So ambivalence, again, is normal. And people will often get stuck between, I want to change, but I don't want to. And they'll lack confidence that they can change. So what MI is trying to do is help the client to resolve that ambivalence toward working toward the change. And the idea would be that ambivalence is not resolved by putting more pressure on the client or trying to persuade the client, but by the client themselves making the argument for change. Let's talk a little bit about the core values of motivational interviewing. This is slide number 9, the spirit of motivational interviewing. And what we're trying to do as an MI practitioner is we're trying to collaborate with the client. That is, we're trying to provide a conducive atmosphere, or kind of a partnership with the client. We find common ground with the client. We're working together as a team, and that's the constant theme that we want to give to the client, that we're working together. I want to work with you is the message I want to give to the client. Evocation. Evocation refers to drawing out the client's concerns, drawing out the client's thoughts. The idea would be that the answer is within the client, and the worker's job is to draw those answers out and help the client to understand their own motivations and understand what's going on inside of themselves because they are themselves are verbalizing it. And then autonomy. Of course, this is a social work value, a self-determination, that the client chooses how and when to change when it makes sense to them, and the client has their own personal responsibility for changing. Of course, these three things are very consistent with social work values. The opposite of motivational interviewing is confrontation, education, and authority. Confrontation would be taking a stance that the person has the problem and they can't see it, but we can see it, and we're going to tell the person how much they have the problem, whether they can see it or not. And that has just not been found to be a helpful approach at all for a lot of people. And then education. We do, as MI practitioners, offer direct advice, but only if the client asks for it. And we always give them the caveat that even though I'm giving you this education, you are still free to use that education in any way you'd like to. So, for example, if I'll typically tell a client that's drinking alcohol that alcohol is a central nervous system depressant that is having an effect on their liver and on their brain, and they have autonomy to decide what they want to do with that information. What I don't want to do is give the sense of the client that I know better than them. I have all this knowledge, and therefore I know better than them. Authority is certainly something I don't want to do as an MI practitioner. I don't want to take a one-up stance that I know what the client needs, and again, I'm the counselor and you're the client, and therefore I'm in a one-up position over you. I do not want to make the client a passive and obedient recipient of my knowledge or my skill. That is not good for building relationship and helping the person resolve ambivalence. And there will be a question on your test about that in terms of am I not being into confrontation as an approach. Next slide talks about the principles of motivational interviewing. And there's four basic principles. Number one is to express empathy. What we want to be doing a lot is communicating, understanding of the client's thoughts and feelings and experiences. We want to demonstrate warmth to them. We want to be non-judgmental to them. Basically, the message I want to give the client is, I get it. I'm joining your world, and I get it. I understand as best as I can what you're going through, what you're thinking, and what you're feeling. Developing discrepancy is also very important for MI. Developing discrepancy, what that really means is you're trying to help the client understand that the way they're behaving right now is not in conflict with their values, that there's a gap between where they are right now and where they want to be. You want to help the client develop awareness of the positive and negative consequences of their current behavior and help them see that they can change that behavior for their good, for something that they're motivated to change. We're going to talk a little bit more about discrepancy later on. Self-sufficiency. We want to bring up the client's belief in their ability to change. We want to help them gain confidence that they can indeed change and make their life better. We want to act in some ways like a cheerleader for that client. And then rolling with resistance. Resistance is something that we want to make use of. We want to understand it. But we want to stay out of the power struggles. We don't want to feed into it. We don't want to challenge it. Instead, we want to reflect it and want to let the client just go with it and try to help them understand where that resistance is coming from. And that will be a question on your test, that the MI practitioner does what we call roll with resistance. And we're going to talk a little bit more about resistance later on. Next slide, what makes for change? MI practitioners believe that there's three basic issues that helps the client be motivated for change. One is that they have to be willing to change, of course, and that starts with recognizing the problem, recognizing that there is something I'm doing right now that's not helping me with what's important to me. A classic example would be at the detox center I work, we have female clients who have opiate addictions or other addictions, and they have children. And sometimes DSS has come in and taken those children away, or those children are living with other people because of their addiction. And they come in, and obviously their children mean a lot to them, and their children, they love their children, they want their children back. So we want to help them develop a discrepancy between their addiction, which is not helping them with their children, not helping them be a good parent, and what they need to do to change in order to be that parent that they want to be. And then we want to do the part in terms of being able, and that is helping the client develop confidence and hope that they indeed can change. And then we want to be able to help the client develop some intentionality. I find that to be a very powerful concept in therapy with my clients, helping the client to develop some intentionality. What I mean by that is some conscious choice and conscious decision that they can make toward change, even whether they feel like it or not. So when you hear the client talking about recognizing their problems, when you hear the client talking about that perhaps they have hope that something can change in their life, and when they start to do some intentional behaviors toward change, then they're really on their way. And then more specifically, the next slide talks about change talk. And these are the kind of statements that the client will make that lets you know that the client is ready, able, and willing to change. And the MI practitioners have a little acrostic that they use to kind of listen for change talk, and it's called DARN, D-A-R-N. And the D stands for desire. So when the client says, you know, I want to stop drinking, for example, or I want to become sober, that's a key word. Whenever they're saying I want to, they're at that point or into what we call change talk. Ability, I can. Go to that AA meeting and go with other people and be with other people that want to be sober. I can begin to change my diet and eat less because I want to lose weight. So anytime the person verbalizes a can statement, that's a change talk. Reasons, that's the R part. I should because. So, for example, the client starts to verbalize why they want to change, what the benefit is of their change. And then need. This is a client that says, I must change because of whatever reason they give. I hear a lot of addicts that I work with talk about, I must change because if I don't, I'm going to potentially die, or if I don't, I'm going to have some serious health problems. So at that point, the client is verbalizing some change talk. And what I would like you to be able to recognize is the difference in change talk versus other types of talk that the client gives. Let me give you some examples. MI has four types of talk they talk about that the client will give you. The first type of talk is what we call the sustained talk, and that is basically status quo. So that's a client that's saying, I'm not sure I want to change, I'm not sure I can, I'm not ready to change, I don't really think it's important for me to make this change. So anytime the client is kind of talking about the status quo, we call that sustained talk, and that usually is not going to get them very far. Then there's a type of talk that is good, but we want to be able to help the client go further, and that's what we call self-exploration talk. So when a client makes an insightful statement about themselves, when they kind of get something that maybe they haven't gotten before, we call that self-exploration talk. For example, a self-exploration talk might be a client saying, I never realized how drinking is affecting my health, and I didn't realize how much my family cares. At that point, the client is getting some insight into the problem and into the fact that they might possibly want to take a look at that, at changing that problem. The third type of talk is what we're going to talk about in the next few minutes, and that is resistance. And again, we hear clients say this all the time, some type of language about, I don't want to change, no one can make me change, I'm not really interested in this changing. I know my family wants me to stop drinking, but I'm not really interested in doing it. So that's what we call resistance change. So what we want to be able to do is we want to be able to help the client get into self-exploration, that we want to help them move into change talk. So, for example, the client that's saying, I never realized how drinking is affecting my health, we want them to move into being able to say, and perhaps because of that, it's time for me to make some change. Perhaps because of that, I want to stop drinking, and perhaps because of that, I believe I can make a change in my drinking. That's the goal of the MI practitioner, to get the client to move in that direction. So it's very important to be able to recognize what we call change talk and be able to capitalize on it, and we're going to be discussing how we can specifically do that in a few minutes. I want to go ahead and talk for a few minutes now about resistance, but before we do that, I want to talk about the stages of change. And again, this is called the trans-theoretical model of change by Prochaska and DiClemente. I do not have the specific reference on me about where this comes from, but if you would like the specific reference, you can email me and I'll look it up for you. But it is in the Motivational Interviewing textbook. And what Prochaska and DiClemente did is they talked about the different stages that a client will go through from resistance all the way to change. So they named their stages of change pre-contemplation, contemplation, preparation, action, and maintenance. Pre-contemplation refers to that resistant client that's not yet considering change, unable, unwilling to change, or don't recognize they even have a problem. And you can pretty easily know when a client is into this type of change when they start using language and words around what we call the four R's: reluctant, rebellious, rationalizing, and resigned. Reluctant would be a client that feels like they're okay where they are, kind of an if it ain't broke, don't fix it kind of mindset. Rebellious client is a client that does not like being told what to do. They are covering up their fears. They could be hostile. They have an investment in the problem behavior. A resigned client would be a client, very often we see this with depression, a client who's just kind of given up. They feel overwhelmed. They feel hopeless. They feel like it's too late to change. Can't teach an old dog new tricks type of attitude. And a rationalizing client is the kind of client that loves to intellectualize or blame others. They have an argument for everything, and whatever you say, they're going to argue it back. So if you see these kind of behaviors in a client, they're probably in the resistance stage, in the pre-contemplation stage. The contemplation stage is a client that has that classic ambivalence. That is, they acknowledge their concerns, but they're not sure they're ready to change yet. So they're uncertain, they're ambivalent, part of them wants to change, part of them doesn't want to, they're kind of on the fence. And there will be a question in your CEU test about what contemplation is. Again, the contemplative client acknowledges concerns, but is ambivalent and uncertain. In the preparation stage, this is when the client starts to use more of that intentional language, when they start to use more of that change language, they're committed to and they're planning change. And at this point, our goal is to help them clarify their goals, make a target area for change. The action stage is a client that's beyond now the preparation. They're actually taking steps toward change. They're actually reaching their goals. They're actually doing what they said they were going to do, and they're getting the benefit from it. And our goal at that point is to reinforce that, to support that, and to continue to help them build their confidence. And then the maintenance stage is the person that's consolidated their gains, consolidated their changes. They're more stable, and they're doing very well. And the thing that's important to recognize about these stages of change is they're very fluid. They can go backwards or forwards, and you can see a client that's in the preparation stage one session, and the next session they've gone back to contemplation. So it's very important as an MI practitioner to always be assessing where in the stages of change a client is. And the next slide, slide 15, is just a visual representation of that. You can see the arrows going around and around, knowing that these stages of change are very fluid. The next slide talks about avoiding MI traps, and these are things that the MI practitioner wants to stay away from. And the first thing is using too many closed questions. A big part of MI theory is asking open-ended questions. And so we want to always ask questions that the client cannot just answer with a yes or no feedback. So I'm going to do a little exercise here where I'm going to state four questions, and the first two are closed-ended questions, and the next two are open-ended questions, and you'll be able to see the difference between closed-ended questions and open-ended questions. So the first two closed-ended questions would be, do you want to stop drinking? Well, that's closed-ended because the client can answer yes or no and not give you any more information. The next closed-ended question, have you ever thought about exercising? Well, again, that's closed-ended because the client can answer yes or no. The next two are open-ended questions. What do you like about drinking? The client hopefully will give you some more information. The next one, what concerns you about smoking? Again, the client will give you some more information about that than just yes or no. So we want to always be asking open-ended questions. The taking sides trap. We don't want to be seen by the client as someone who is trying to push them to change, someone that's trying to take sides. A classic example would be the wife complains about the husband's drinking, and we say to the client, I think your wife is right, you need to stop drinking. Well, that's probably going to make the client more defensive to take the side of the wife. Number C, the expert trap. Again, we don't want to be seen as giving all the answers. We don't want to be seen as knowing it all and putting the client in a passive role. The labeling trap, labeling or forcing a diagnosis, stigmatizing the client. When I do substance abuse counseling, I try to really stay away from the word addict unless the client says it themselves, because my concern is if I start throwing that word around, they're going to get defensive and feel like they're being pigeonholed. Even though it may be obvious that they have a substance-dependent problem, I'm very reluctant to start labeling and using the word addict. And premature focus trap, this is kind of trying too hard to hone in on the problem, trying too hard to hone in on what you think the problem is without letting the client tell you what they think the problem is and kind of overwhelming the client before they're ready. And the bottom line on that slide, number 16, avoid being right at the expense of the therapy relationship. I heard this several years ago, and I wish I could remember who said it, and I apologize for not having the person who said this, but I heard this somewhere along the line, and I just love that saying, avoid being right at the expense of the therapy relationship. The relationship should always come first. Moving on to the next slide, recognizing resistance. And there's obviously some ways that you can know the client is resisting. If they're arguing with you, if they're interrupting, if they're blaming, excusing, minimizing, if they're just simply not paying attention to you, if they're ignoring you, don't get any responses from them. And certainly resistance behaviors can involve not following through on assignments, missing sessions, things like that. So obviously, we do get clients that are under resistance, and we want to be able to respond to that resistance in the way that will help the client hopefully move toward not being so resistant. And we're going to talk about how to do that right now in the next slide, responding to resistance. I really enjoy this part of MI. I think this has really helped me stay out of power struggles with clients and really help me relax when the client is resistant. Sometimes as social workers, I think we have a tendency to get a little tense and not know what to do when the client is resisting us. I really like some of the concepts that MI has come up with. So let's go over them. Slide number 18, responding to resistance. So if a client says a resistance statement, one of the things we can do is simply reflect back that statement, and that's called a simple reflection. So an example would be a client saying, "I can't believe I'm coming to this stupid place." Oftentimes referring an adolescent to who's coming to counseling. I get that a lot from adolescents. "I can't believe I'm coming to this stupid place. I'd rather be playing video games right now than be sitting here talking to you." And my response simply is just to tell them, "You sound like you're unhappy about being here." Just that simple statement of just reflecting their resistance. "You sound like you're unhappy about being here." Oftentimes that lowers the tension a little bit and helps the client to understand that I'm not going to get into power struggles with them. I'm simply just going to acknowledge that they don't want to be in the therapy session today. And then there's amplified reflection. That's where you reflect with a little bit more information. So I'll give you some examples of that. Let's say a client is hooked on opiates, or they're opiate dependent, and I might get this resistance statement from them. "How can you help me? You don't know what it's like to have to take all these pain pills." My response would be, "It's difficult for you to trust that I can help you." So I'm reflecting back what I think I'm hearing, that they're basically saying they're not sure they can trust that I can help them. So that simple statement, "It's difficult for you to trust that I can help you," again, hopefully will cut down a little bit on the tension and the resistance. Another example would be a husband whose wife is complaining about his drinking. And the husband says, "She's always on my case about drinking. It's not that big of a deal." My response to the client might be, "You feel she has no reason to worry." So I'm reflecting back that resistance that he's basically saying that, in his opinion, she has nothing to worry about. If I wanted to get a little bit more sophisticated, I could move into double-sided reflections, and that is reflecting both ways of thinking and feeling. So an example would be, a client says to me, "I just can't give up drinking on the weekends with my friends, but I've had a couple of blackouts and I'm concerned about them." My statement back to the client could be, "You see that your alcohol use causes problems, but your time with your friends are really important." So I'm reflecting back the ambivalence of the client. They're beginning to see that alcohol does cause blackouts, but I'm acknowledging that their time with their friends, and presumably their time drinking with their friends, is really important. I can also shift focus. I can shift attention to the common ground. So, for example, we have a client that does not want to be in that session. He's been forced to come to that session by a probation officer or by some external person, and he's making very clear that he doesn't want to be there. We can just simply spend some time focusing on that. I can just talk about how he feels about being here and reflect that he doesn't want to be here, and I understand that, and I appreciate him sharing that with me. And hopefully that common ground can kind of get us off that anger and hostility that he's feeling, and perhaps we can be able to move on to something else. I use that with adolescents all the time and find it to be very helpful, just kind of acknowledging and appreciating their honesty and letting me know that they don't want to be here today. Reframing is another way that we can respond to resistance. This is Virginia Satir. Those of you who remember studying her, she was great at reframing. For example, a client says to me, "Alcohol helps me relieve my stress." I hear that a lot. "Alcohol helps me relieve my stress." What I can come back and say to the client is, "It really sounds like it's important for you to relieve stress." So I'm acknowledging that they want to relieve stress, and I think that's a good thing, but perhaps we can maybe talk about another way to relieve stress besides drinking. We can also agree with the client but offer a little twist. So, for example, if, again, I'm just going to use the husband and wife kind of thing, just to use the same example. If a husband is persistent that they've been brought into therapy because of concerns about their drinking, and they're pre-contemplative, they don't want to stop drinking, and they start to say things like, "My wife's got problems too, and, you know, why isn't she in counseling? She's got just as many problems as I do." I can actually agree with that, but add a little twist to it. I could say something like, I'm sure your wife is struggling in some ways, and my sense is that both of you are really struggling right now. Both of you are having some issues and some difficulties. So I'm agreeing that the wife does have problems, but I'm also putting a twist on it that perhaps he is also struggling too. And then we always want to emphasize choice. We want to emphasize that the client and only the client can make a change, and what the client does in that counseling session is completely up to them. So these are some ways to deal with resistance that I found to be very, very helpful. And that'll be a question on your CEU test in terms of what are some ways of which MI practitioners respond to resistance. Okay, I've got to speed up a little bit here because of time, so I'm just going to go through these slides fairly quickly here. Number 9, the core skills of MI. We have a little cross-tick called ORS, open-ended questions, affirmations, reflective listening, and summarizing. We just talked about the open-ended questions a few minutes ago. The affirmation would be affirming the client for coming in, affirming the client for sharing, affirming the client for working on making a change. Reflective listening, we've talked about that, how we've just simply reflect back what the client's saying. And summarizing, that's really important to be able to summarize what the client has said to us. So, for example, if a client says, I've been trying to stick to my diet, but I still can't seem to lose any weight, I can reflect back that it's frustrating to stick to your plan and feel like you're not getting the payoff for it. So I'm summarizing what they've just said, that they're trying to stick to that diet, but they just can't seem to get the results yet, and I'm reflecting that back to the client. So that will be a question on your test in terms of the core MI skills of open-ended questions, affirmation, reflective listening, and summarizing. And then another acrostic that MI practitioners like to use, I guess they're pretty big on these acrostics here, is slide number 20. We call this EARS, elaborating, affirming, reflecting, and summarizing. When you hear a client talking about change, when you hear a client using those change statements, that change talk that we referred to before, the I can statements, the I will statements, I believe I need to change type of statements, at that point we want to really help the client elaborate that. Whenever the client makes a statement about change, we want to ask for detail. We want to really ask them to give as many details as possible. So, for example, if a client I've worked with has relapsed, but he's been sober before, I want to know as much as I can about what helped that client stay sober for those 6 months. I want him to give me all the details about how was he able to stay sober for those 6 months, what really, really helped him. And that way he can begin to talk again about and hear himself verbalize how he was able to do that. So anytime the client gives you any statements about change, you want to really be able to kind of milk that for all it's worth, so to speak, and really help them to get specific as possible about that change talk. And we want to affirm them, we want to reflect back their statements, and we always want to summarize. And summarizing means that we want to be able to give them a short paragraph about what we hear them saying, so they're really beginning to get the sense that we understand them. And again, if we give them that paragraph about what they're saying, they hear me say it. If they say it again, then they're hearing themselves say that self-talk out loud. And that's what MI says is so effective. When the client himself begins to hear that change, that change talk, they hear me say it, they hear themselves say it, then they're starting to move toward change. Some important strategies of MI. We're going to move to slide 21. One is called the decisional balance, and that basically is you help the client explore the pros and cons of their current behavior and the pros and cons of changing. So, again, I'm just going to use the alcohol example because I do a lot of substance abuse use of work. So a client that's drinking, we can talk about what they feel like they're getting from their drinking, but what the costs are of their drinking. If they stay sober or if they move towards sobriety, what would be the benefits of that? What would be the barriers of that? What would be the good things about being sober? What are they concerned about being sober? I can really help the client kind of explore the pros and cons of changing. Developing discrepancy. We've talked about that before, and there's a good example of Jesus doing that we're going to refer to in a few minutes. And if you recall, discrepancy is helping the client see a difference between what they're doing now and some important value in their life. We want to help the client understand that what they're doing now is not consistent with what they say is important to them. So again, I use the example of the woman addicted to opiates. their parenting, their children, being with their children, being a good parent is very important to them, and yet their addiction is preventing them from doing that. So that's kind of a classic example of discrepancy there. And I want to continue to verbalize that and help the client verbalize that discrepancy, that difference between what they're doing now and where they want to go and how they want to change. Another MI skill that I find really helpful, and I use this all the time, is what they call importance and confidence rulers. And let me give you an example of that. In general, clients can be ready to change when they perceive both the importance for change and they believe they can change. So I would ask the client, for example, on a scale of 0 to 10, with 0 not being important at all and 10 being very important, how important is it to you that you make this change? Let's say, for example, that they say a 5. My next statement to them will be, tell me why it's a 5 and not a 0. In other words, I want to help them understand what the basis of that 5 is. And then I can ask them, what might you need to do to get that number up to a 7 or 8? And help them really explore why it's important for them to make that change and what would help them make it even more important for them to make that change. And then I want to talk about their confidence. So I'll ask the same question. On a scale of 0 to 10, how confident are you that you can make this change, with 0 not being confident at all and 10 being extremely confident? If they say 3 or 4, I will come back and say, why is it 3 and not a 0? So again, I'm trying to get them to explore, on what basis did they say 3? And usually what they'll say is, well, I made a change before in my life. There was something I did before that was a problem for me, and I made this change. And I will come back and say, wow, yay, fantastic. Let's talk about that. Let's talk about how you made that change the last time. What did you do that helped you? And as I'm doing that, hopefully they're getting more confident that they can make a change this time because they've done it in the past. So I love that importance confidence questions because it really gets to the core of what the client is thinking about their motivations. Value sort card, that refers to cards that you can actually order through the Motivational Interviewing website. These are cards that have different values on them, such as family, God's will, job, things like that. And what you do is that you have them sort out what their 5 most important cards are. In other words, what are their 5 most important values that are really crucial to them right now? Then you can take those 5 important values and you can ask them questions. How specifically are they practicing these values? What are they doing right now that is a barrier to practicing these values? How does this fit with what they're doing in their life and where they want to go? So, for example, if I have a client who says that God's will is one of the most important things in their life, I can ask them, how specifically are they practicing God's will? What's an obstacle to achieving God's will? What are they doing right now that could be a barrier to achieving God's will? So I can be able to use that value that they themselves said was important to them and ask them questions about that. Using extremes, this is an example where you go to the best and worst. So, for example, if a client's drinking and they don't want to stop drinking, I might ask them something like, what do you think the worst thing will happen will be if you continue drinking? And obviously, at that point, they might say something like, well, my health will go downhill. I'll continue to have a bad liver. My wife will continue to be angry at me. And again, I can help them understand that if they don't stop drinking, some things might happen in their life that they don't want to happen. I can also ask the opposite question. What might be the best possible thing that would happen if you did change? So going back to the alcohol example, if you develop sobriety, if you were able to stay sober, what might be the best possible thing that would happen? So I love those kind of questions, too, because it really gets the client to think about the worst of not changing and the best of changing. And then looking back and forth, you can ask the client to remember how their life was before the problem began. You can ask them to what they would like their life to look like in the future. And you can get them to really take a look at their life in the past and where they want to go in the future. And that will also be a question on your CEU test about these different type of strategies that MI practitioners can use. I'm going to skip the change talk quiz in the interest of time, but there's a change talk quiz on slide 22. There's 6 statements there, and you can decide whether that's change talk or not, or is it sustained talk, is it resistance talk, or self-exploration talk, and you can kind of do your own answering of those questions there just in the interest of time. Slide 23, recognize readiness for actions. How will you know that a client's getting ready to change? Well, there'll be several clues. You'll have decreased resistance. They'll be making fewer statements about the problem, more about change. They'll be making more self-motivational statements. They'll actually be experimenting with some type of change, and you will hear more change talk out of the client. So part of our job as MI practitioners is to really listen very carefully for that change talk and notice when the client's starting to use it more. So let's say a client starts to verbalize more change talk and they want to work toward a specific type of change. Well, you can help them negotiate a change plan. That's the next slide, negotiate a change plan. And this is where you want to get as specific as possible about what are the goals they want to change, what are the reasons they want to make that change. And then you want to ask those typical W questions: who, what, where, when, what is change going to look like? Get them to be as specific as possible. What obstacles could interfere with the change, and how will you handle those obstacles? What will be the signs of progress? How will you know the change is working? And what are some, who are some people that can encourage and support you? MI is really big on getting support, helping people to understand that it's very difficult to change alone, that usually we need other people in our life to be able to help us make changes. And then the next slide, the maintenance of changes. If the client is into the maintenance stage of change, we want to help them continue to support that, continue to work with them, continue to review how they're doing, and if there's any sign of regression, we want to be able to have a plan in place for dealing with that regression. Okay, so let's go ahead and talk. We have a few minutes here. Let's talk about biblical theology and motivational interviewing. And unfortunately, I'm not going to have a lot of time to talk about this, but we'll do the best we can. There is a slide called Biblical Theology and MI. We talked about collaboration, evocation, autonomy, and expressing empathy as motivational interviewing values. Collaboration can be found in Hebrews 10, 24, and 25. It talks about spurring one another on to love and good deeds and encouraging and meeting together. Ecclesiastes talks about two are better than one. A cord of three strands is not easily broken. Jesus modeled collaboration where he sent the disciples out two by two as a team. Notice he didn't send the disciples out alone to start ministering to others. He always sent them out two by two so they could collaborate together to minister. And in the feeding of the 5,000, Jesus, again, was for teamwork. He just didn't provide the food on his own. He asked the disciples to help him, and he asked the disciples to actually collect the food and to give it to the hungry people. So it was a team approach in that miracle. And Paul talks about working out our salvation, letting God work in us, kind of a merging of the human and the divine. We're called to work out our salvation. God can enable us to do that. And there's many ways that we can do that in Scripture. In terms of evocation, Jesus was very good at drawing out the thoughts and concerns of others. On the Emmaus Road in Luke 24, Jesus asks the disciples, "What are you discussing together?" Notice the open-ended question. And then in verse 19, he asks another open-ended question, "What things are going on? What things are you hearing about?" And of course, they were discussing the fact that Jesus supposedly had been seen and had supposedly had resurrected from the dead. And so Jesus was asking them the open-ended questions because he wanted to find out what they were thinking and what was going on with them. In his book about prayer, Philip Yancey notes that people approach Jesus with a question almost 200 times in Scripture. He replied with a direct answer only several times. Usually he responded to questions with another question, or a parable, or some other response. But Jesus was very good at asking open-ended questions. That will be a question on your CEU test. In terms of autonomy, obviously we have free will as human beings. The fall in Genesis 3 taught us that. The rich young ruler turned down an invitation from Jesus to believe in him. And there's other examples in Scripture of people exercising their autonomy. And there's other examples of Scripture of people that disobey Jesus and obey Jesus. So certainly autonomy is a biblical value. And then empathy is certainly a biblical value. Jesus often expressed compassion, and there's several examples in Scripture of Jesus expressing empathy and compassion to others. The next slide talks about the biblical theory in terms of developing discrepancy and self-efficacy and rolling with resistance. Jesus was very good at recognizing that a person's experience was different than what they wanted. For example, he recognized that the woman who touched his robe had physical problems and wanted to be healed. There was a discrepancy about what she was experiencing and the way she wanted her life to be. He even recognized the discrepancy with the rich young ruler, that the rich young ruler had a lot of money, but was inside himself, he was unfulfilled. But of course, he was not willing to do the heart change that Jesus asked him to do. And then a great example of discrepancy, probably one of the greatest biblical examples we have, is Paul, who himself said, the things I want to do, I don't do, and the things I don't want to do, I end up doing. And I think all of us are familiar with that verse in Romans 7, where Paul talks about his inner dividedness, and that's a classic example of discrepancy. Self-efficacy. People responded to Jesus in different ways with their own free will. The blind man followed him. The leper disobeyed him. The Samaritan leper thanked him. The woman at the well spoke to him. And then Paul talks about being able to leave the past behind and press on toward the goal of winning the heavenly prize. Rolling with resistance. Jesus did not force himself upon anyone. In John 6:60 and Matthew 19:16-24 are examples of people being with Jesus, being exposed to him, and yet they still resisted him. Now, one way in which MI is incompatible with Scripture, and that is in self-efficacy. And that is self-efficacy only goes so far in the Christian life. Our faith clearly teaches that we cannot change ourselves. Salvation and heart change only comes from God, and as believers, we continue to rely on God's power. Our own belief often is not enough. We need faith in God. For the believer, change comes through spiritual transformation, and the Bible constantly reminds us that true life change only comes through God's power. So that's the one area that spirituality can really help in terms of working with someone in MI, is letting them know that they can make change, they can make choices, but also part of making changes is to trust in God and to allow God's power to change a person. Examples of Jesus using MI skills. Now, the parable of the sower. I kind of took this parable and I compared it to the stages of change. So, for example, the person who hears but does not understand, I consider to be pre-contemplative. The example of the person who receives the word, but the worries of life choke it, I consider to be contemplative. An example of a person who hears the word and understands it is preparation. And the person who hears the word, understands it, and produces fruit is action. So I just kind of took that parable of the sower and compared it to the stages of change in Procrasta and De Clementi, and I thought it was kind of an interesting comparison to make. Zacchaeus is one of my favorite biblical stories. Zacchaeus was into contemplation. That is, there was a part of him that was perhaps realizing that maybe a tax collector is not what he wanted to do, or maybe he was cheating people through his tax collecting. So he climbed up a tree, got a view of Jesus. Jesus recognized his contemplation, told him to come down off the tree, and then gave him an action plan of coming to his house and accepting him by faith. And then his follow-up action plan was to give back to the people he had cheated. And I think that's a great biblical story about a heart change that a person underwent in Zacchaeus. The woman at the well, Jesus developed a discrepancy between living water and temporary water. The woman was focusing on temporary water to satisfy her thirst. Jesus developed a discrepancy that she really wanted in her heart, living water that would satisfy her soul. She asked for an action plan, and Jesus gave her an action plan of leaving her water jar and telling others about Jesus, and she indeed did that. And that will be a question on your CEU test in terms of Jesus developing discrepancy and asking for an action plan. We've already made the point that Jesus constantly asked open-ended questions. We have examples of that in Scripture. And then finally, I want us to think about, as we wrap up here before we have question, is the fact that really any of the MI skills can be used in a biblical, spiritual way. So, for example, you can ask some open-ended questions about where a person feels like God is leading them to change. How do you think God might be concerned about this problem in your life? How might you go about in a way that pleases God, being able to make this change? We can ask them about the biblical figures that they identify with that made a change. We can ask them about their favorite Bible verse or favorite Bible story and how that verse or that Bible story can help them in their motivation to change. And I love the example of the using the extremes. So, for example, we talked about using the extremes, and that is helping the client to understand what's the worst that could happen if they continue this in this problem. So I can ask a client, let's go back to the drinking example. I can ask a client, what do you hope to gain by continuing to drink? And how might you be able to obtain that same goal in a way consistent with your faith? How might you redeem this pattern in your life? So what I'm working with a client on is they're getting some need met by their drinking. But if this client has faith, how might they be able to get that need met using their faith? And I can ask a client, in terms of helping them get confidence in themselves, I can help them describe a time when they believe God helped them make a change. Give me an example of a time that you believe God helped you through a situation. So, again, I think any of the MI skills can be used in biblical, using theological and biblical language. And
thank you for joining us today for NECSW's Podcast of the Month featured selection. We hope you found today's session useful and that it will support your efforts to ethically integrate Christian faith and social work practice. We also hope that you will consider participating in additional NECSW activities and events, such as NECSW's upcoming Convention 2011 in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, from October 20th to 23rd, our quarterly audio conference workshops that we offer at no cost to NECSW members, and access to dozens of archived podcasts from the member section of our website. Also, we invite you to join NECSW's Facebook group or our Facebook fan page. For additional information about these and other NECSW benefits and services, you can go to our website at www.nacsw.org. Thanks again for listening into our podcast session today.